Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley, back in our usual studio after what seems like years on the road for the party conference season. Once again, by popular demand, I'm declaring this week's episode a Brexit-free zone so we can look in more detail at some of the other big things happening in politics right now. If anyone does use the B word, you'll hear my Brexit klaxon, which this week sounds like this. Joining me this week are Lucy Fisher, senior political correspondent for The Times on cutting the cost of politics, Katie Perrier, Theresa May's former director of communications and now Times columnist on the perils of reshuffles, and Daniel Finkelstein on trouble at home and abroad. If you've got a burning question about the state of British politics, get in touch. Tweet us at TimesRedBox or email redbox@thetimes.co.uk and we'll at least try to answer your questions in the coming weeks. Right then, let's get started and we begin with Lucy Fisher. And who is suffering from peer pressure?
The House of Lords is looking at 15-year time limits for new peers and ways of slashing its size after its 800-odd members last year agreed it was a bloated institution. It's not the size that's the fundamental problem with the chamber, however. It's the cronyism. The current review may be welcomed as a start by some campaigners, but to my mind, it's misguided. It doesn't tackle the appointment system that renders the chamber the plaything of party leaders.
So Lucy, this is a good scoop by you on the front page of the Times. You're right, though, that the interesting thing is that there are people who have a fundamental problem with the existence of the House of Lords and with the way that they're appointed to it. Mm-hmm. And just putting a time limit on how long new peers can stay for doesn't really address... It's sort of... The Lords in this particular committee seem to be coming up with sort of increasingly inventive ways of trying to do things around the edges because nobody... can tackle the fundamental issue.
Yes, well, this committee that's been convened by the Lord Speaker, a cross-party committee of peers who've been tasked with consulting members of the House, the public, and trying to come up with consensual ways to reduce its number. That's the remit of the report. So it's not supposed to be looking at the appointment system. And I think that the proposals that we've discovered that they're going to recommend, the time limits, and asking each party to make a commitment to reduce its number in stages, it is interesting. But to my mind, I just think we need to push back against the argument that we need to reduce the size of the Lords. I just don't see on what grounds that should be the case. People argue about the cost. Well, frankly, you know, peers are entitled to claim £300 a day for the days they work. Overall, if you slash the House by 200, even 300 peers, you're saving, you know, a few million pounds a year, probably not even £10 million a year. It is chicken feed in the grand scheme of things. You know, there's no argument that it's, you know, overcrowding. You know, many peers don't turn up to every, you know, bill or every vote. And to my mind, that's a good thing. We want a second chamber, an editing revision chamber that boasts rich spectrum of experience and people that have other interests, other jobs. So my contention is that what's really damaged the reputation of the Lord is not the fact that there are 800 of them. It's that David Cameron so abused the system since 2010 by stuffing stuffing the red benches with so many new party political appointments. And I think that's the view of many peers. Betty Boothroyd, former Commons Speaker, last year accused him of tarnishing the reputation of the House by abusing the system this way.
I feel like I should come to you, Danny.
Yes, of course you should. And well, first of all, I do agree with you, Lucy, about the numbers. So that is.
So should we explain that you as well as being a columnist at the Times, yes. You also sit in the House of Lords as
and
a Tory.
And was an appointment of David Cameron. Yeah. Yeah, it's worthwhile saying that. So it's important to what I'm about to say. The first thing is, I agree with you, Lucy, about the number of peers. You know, yesterday I was there for the Space Industries Bill. It had a few peers in it. Those people who had a knowledge, expertise, or interest in that particular area. And really, there may have been 20 people there. It's very rare that you think to yourself, my goodness, there are many too many people here. I do actually happen to think the allowance system doesn't work as it should. Mm-hmm. It's a system that was designed as a panic response to the position that was of the MPs and to one or two peers going to jail for their expenses. I actually think IPSA should be asked to look at it and come up with a system that works, because it's supposed to cover costs. It's not supposed to be a payment for peers. There's then a question of how you do compensate peers for the time that they spent, if you decide that you want to do that. And of course, we're putting to one side here altogether the idea of whether an unelected House is a good way of dealing with the problem of how you scrutinise legislation. Every time I think it's a terrible idea, and I think there's a lot to be said against it, I then come up with the problem, well, what do you replace it with? Mm. And then I end up thinking, well, maybe we should just not have a second House at all, and that's also not a good idea. So let's put all that to one side. Then there's this issue of cronyism. Look, it's really embarrassing to have to deal with it, because it's an obvious question I was put there by David Cameron, and if you describe that as cronyism, that's a perfectly reasonable description. I'll take it on the chin. It is not my view, of course, it wouldn't be, would it, that is a serious problem. When I got into the House of Lords, I felt actually the balance in the Lords was there was a lot of expertise, but often not very much political knowledge. And I thought David Cameron attempted to redress that. I didn't think it was unbalanced, because Tony Blair had put in a lot of peers. But it did illustrate an obvious problem, which is, where do you stop? You know, David could have ended up chasing a majority in the House of Lords, and then somebody else would get in and chase a majority there. And there was no obvious end to that. It's very difficult for me to say whether the people that were put in, including me, are of adequate quality, right? A lot of people will have to make that judgment. It isn't my judgment. And the other thing I'm a bit wary of is this: peers who get in, like Betty Boothroyd, who was herself a Labour MP for years, of course they kind of regard a load of other nouveau Tories coming in as being tarnishing the reputation of the House, you know, as opposed to other perfectly good people like Sally Morgan or Spencer Livermore, who were also put in the House. So the moment you get into this question of who is and who isn't a crony, becomes difficult. But I acknowledge that I'm the last person really who can make an objective judgment about that, and I don't attempt to do so.
Lucy, and then we'll bring in Katie.
I accept certainly what you say, Danny, and I think, you know, of course, my sort of argument here is certainly not a personal attack on you. And also, you mentioned people, I think, you know, like Spencer Livermore, a former Labour aide, you know, you, like he, have dedicated much of your life to politics. You do have an incredible wealth of knowledge, you know, and wisdom to bring to bear. But my problem is more, you know, with donors, people who seem just so random, not even experts or particularly successful in their own field, apart from being wealthy. It's those people, yeah. I think, the sense that, you know, a place in the Lords can be bought, which is quite so distasteful.
Matt, it's very interesting. One of the things about this crony mm-hmm. issue is that when a leader is attempting to put together a list, one of the things they try to do is to put together a list with a bit of diversity in it, because one of the advantages of the House of Lords, because you can pick a selection of people, you want to make sure that it's ethnically diverse and it's diverse on gender. But of course, leaders' inner circles are sometimes not that diverse. So what they then do is go and put into the Lords people they don't, in fact, know all that well. Weirdly, I don't think the problem with these appointments is cronyism. I think it's sort of random choices in which the leader's kind of reaching out into a... Now, I don't want to pick out any particular party in the House, in which is unfair on colleagues, and also sometimes I don't know them well enough to make the judgment that's a flip one. But I would observe that Lucy is correct in thinking it might be a good idea to have the Lords Appointments Commission review the quality of the appointments, as well as the propriety of them. And I suspect the people they have a problem with will not end up being what one might describe as cronies, but people who in fact don't know the leader all that well, but were selected in order to, you know, make sure they had someone from the business field who may not necessarily be a donor, by the way, but who fulfilled some other criteria.
Katie, we need the Finkelstein review.
What do you make of all this? Where do you stand on the House of Lords?
I'm a massive fan of the House of Lords. Purely because
you've gone down in my estimation.
Sorry, mate. Purely because I've worked for several members of the Lords over my career and who have been extremely experienced and massively knowledgeable. And I sometimes would only wish that some of that knowledge would be in the House of Commons more before the Lords would have to kind of stick their ear, you know, nose in and make some of the decisions they had to. Over the years. So I've become very much, I fell in love with the House of Lords in many respects in my early 20s because that was not a place for me at all. And yet I was made to feel very at home very early on. And I feel very much like Danny does in terms of, yes, there are major flaws with it, but what is the alternative? I really worry about a House of Lords that's full of people that didn't make it into the House of Commons, a kind of second-rate chamber.
That's what it is now.
It really isn't that
now. But it's
now.
Full of loads of people who lost their seats.
It's full of loads of people that are absolutely knowledgeable in their 60s and 70s shouldn't turn around and tell you.
It's actually not full. Right, so of those people.
Well, there are lots of people there who have been ejected by the electorate.
There are some people of whom that's true.
Yeah.
And sometimes those you are capturing by putting those people some extra expertise. And what I think overall you have to ask this question to how well does it work? And I would say, actually, it's a mixed answer. I think the House of Lords is extremely good at agreeing with the House of Commons, in fact, that the House of Commons legislation isn't adequate and should be reformed. There is a question over whether there's now too much party voting in the House of Lords so that you're not getting quite as much independence as you would want.
I'd
so
agree
there
with
are
that.
Criticisms to make. I thought when you wrote a piece on this in the Times, it was brilliant, as your pieces always are, it was brilliantly witty and contained a lot of truth in it, but I just thought it was over the top. And like that statement, it's full of people who that's not true.
My fundamental point in that piece that I wrote was the people who are writing or rewriting the laws of the land should be chosen by the people who are affected by it.
I agree with
that. And the defence for having unelected people writing the laws of the land is just that alternatives might be slightly messier and not as good.
Well, that's not true. So that's a fair point. But there are two, I think, answers to this. The first is it's not true completely about how we write the law of the land, because quite a lot of law is at the very least interpreted by judges, and they're not elected, and we wouldn't want them to be elected. And yet we have, with the Human Rights Act now, got judges with quite a lot of what one... You know, of course, lawyers will say they're interpreting the law, but that is actually not the case. They are creating what the law means, and they're not elected. So, in other words, as a check on the House of Commons, we already have an unelected layer. So it's not a principle that's unknown to us, right? And the second question is, if you had an elected House of Lords, it would do, and I've seen this now because I'm in it, it would do one of two things. Either it would reject everything, or it would accept everything. Right, because it would vote along party lines, and I completely agree with everything that you've said, and have always been a supporter of having an elected second chamber until Nick Clegg came up with his proposal. This is before I was in the chamber. Nick Clegg came up with his proposal, and I thought to myself, that would be terrible. It was a terrible idea.
Because what did you try? Katie, what's your understanding of where Theresa May is on this? Because there was always a perception that George Osborne was a bit keener on Lords reform than David Cameron was. Is this? I mean, she's got quite a lot on her plate. I assume this isn't on her radar.
I don't see a massive appetite to change things, other than the fact that the real imbalance in terms of the amount of Conservatives in there. So that's frustrating for any Prime Minister trying to get legislation through that you can't do that because the balance as it is at the moment. I think there's something to be said for the balance of age in the Lords, and that's why some Prime Ministers do try to give it a balance. I was absolutely horrified. This might be a controversial thing to say, but when Michelle Mohn went into the House of Lords, because I felt that just because of business experience didn't really cut it for me in terms of ability to perform well in the House of Lords. And we can be critical of David Cameron's appointments, but one of them recently, Liz Sugg, is doing a tremendously difficult job in the House of Lords and working really hard. She's taking it on board as this kind of full-time job that she's going to do a really good job at. And so I think that some of them actually are dedicated to doing a good job in there.
Lucy.
I was just going to say, I agree with you, Katie, that there isn't any appetite from ministers for the government to bring legislation to change laws. But that's precisely why the Lord Speaker has convened this committee, so the Lords can sort out the issue among themselves. I think there is a kind of broad agreement in the House of Lords that there does need to be change. But one thing I just wanted to flag is that I think a huge crisis could be coming down the line in the Lords over Brexit legislation.
You've said Brexit, but we'll ignore that.
Contravene your ban.
He didn't even use his kind of
his buzzer
thing.
Keep going.
But just to say, I think, you know, the Lords has survived thus far because it's always sort of acknowledged the supremacy of the Commons. And I think if there is a move by peers, and I'd be interested to hear very briefly what Danny thinks about this, to block or substantially change Brexit legislation, I think that could be a major constitutional crisis.
It could be, but I suspect what will happen is that they'll send it back and try and test the view of the Commons, but won't push, you know, which is what happened the first time. You know, and one of the things that stops the Lords, because the Lords is not elected, it exercises a degree of self-restraint. It's always exercised that. When it stops exercising that degree of self-restraint, it will have undermined itself constitutionally, and it'll undermine the argument I've made, right, which is, what's the alternative? Well, then it will not be an alternative itself, and that will be the end. You know, and that's... That's all right.
Well, it's fascinating, and I'm sure it's something that we'll come back to again in the future. But let's move on now, and this is Katie Perrier on something that could be happening in politics rather sooner.
Westminster is once again rife with rumour of a pending reshuffle by the Prime Minister. If it is to take place within the next fortnight, it will be highly likely the Chancellor gets to stay to deliver his much-anticipated bold budget. Boris, too, is unlikely to be moved. Instead, a few poor, loyal ministers will probably be chopped to make way for some of the newer MPs, having watched the others do a mediocre job of running things and now fancy a go at it themselves. Alongside a new party chairman, this move is likely to keep both sides of the party quiet, but for how much longer? This has all the signs of a ruffle rather than a shuffle.
Well, we all love a bit of reshuffle speculation. We think you expect it to be after the EU summit, but probably not long after?
I think within the next fortnight, if it's going to happen at all. And therefore, because it probably won't be the big, bold kind of change that people were expecting maybe earlier in the summer.
Is it going to be a bit Theresa May-ish, do you think?
I think it might be. It might just be kind of steady as it goes. It's promoting a few people that may be the future of tomorrow. You never know. That to show whether or not they're up to scratch in rather than saying things from the sidelines, getting involved. And as I say, a few people may be chopped as a result that probably haven't done anything wrong, but just haven't kind of shone during that time.
So let's talk names then. Let's start with Boris. You've worked with Boris on his two London Mayoral campaigns. You know him well, and you've then obviously worked alongside him when you were in Number 10. Do you think he'll get the sack? Does he deserve the sack? Is he only going to survive because he's more trouble outside the tent than inside?
I think that he will stay, and I think that Boris kind of goes up and down, and when he's not at the top table or when he feels that he's not being listened to, then he really does flex his muscles, and so he goes back to being regular Boris when that's happened. And I think probably the Prime Minister's got used to that and has figured, actually, it's not worth having him on the outside. She's done this job over the last period of time, over the last year, you know, sitting on the fence and really balancing the act between the Remainers and the Brexiteers within the party. Sorry, I've mentioned the word. I promise I wasn't going to. But it's unavoidable when you're talking about reshuffle to not mention the B word. That's Brexit, not Boris. But I think Boris will stay. I think the Chancellor will stay. And I think it'll be a middle-ranking kind of change.
Do you think there'll be any other change in the Cabinet?
Other than party chairman. And maybe one or two moves. I can see a potential that you have to promote someone one or two to the Cabinet and make those changes. But most of it, I think, will be unchanged, and it'll be ministerial level.
Lucy, what do you expect from the reshuffle?
You know, there's people urging the Prime Minister to make really big changes. Others, whip, certainly urging more caution, as I understand it. But I think as well as the sort of the Brexit divide and people lining up between, you know, Philip Hammond and Boris Johnson over their predictions for our withdrawal from the EU. I think there's also a question of competence. I think a lot of people feel that over recent weeks, the cabinets look pretty shambolic due to a number of gaffes. You know, Boris first quoting this Rudyard Kipling poem that insulted the Buddha in Myanmar, then making a gaffe about clearing dead bodies from Sirte in Libya in some sort of flip comment, a joke that went wrong. Philip Hammond last week describing the EU as the enemy. I think there are people sort of who think that she should perhaps have a shake up to get rid of people who are sort of gaffe prone as much as sort of politically at odds with their vision.
And who would you see being on the up? Who are the names to look out for?
Well, I certainly think that there does need to be some tidbits thrown to the 2015 generation who are agitating now. They've kind of come of age in such a tumultuous time that I think they feel they've sort of gained in 2 years a sort of experience that many people gain every decade. I think certainly Tom Tugendhat is someone who's made waves. James Cleverly has been pretty open about his pitch for party chairman. That would be interesting to see what happens, particularly in that role, given Patrick McLaughlin is sort of so widely known to be unhappy there, and you know, has been blamed for some of the misfortunes of the conference.
Well, he's been blamed for literally everything. Blamed for
it's
the election
really
that he had no great part.
I mean, I have written in the Times that he should go, but not because of magnetic lettering or the fact that you know they let a prankster get that close to the Prime Minister. I think you need someone new, innovative, with radical ideas to be party chairman at this time.
And do you think a sort of bigger Conservative HQ operation with some people coming up with ideas, policy development happening in, you know, lower ranking MPs, but giving them a sort of first rung on the ladder?
Well, the Conservatives have lost the ability to surprise anymore. We just, you know, we're trying to out-Corbyn Corbyn. You know, we're trying to be kind of socialism light. And I don't think that cuts it. And therefore, you do need a hotbed of ideas, and you do need to be having that homegrown talent internally. But it's not just about the size, it's about the quality of what you offer. We really need to invest heavily in social media, for example. We are way behind on that, and it's embarrassing.
The Instagram account joined party conference, behind-the-scenes pictures of
pretty lame
Damien Green with his hand in his pocket, was not going to go viral.
There were the rumours afterwards that some of this stuff's due to cutbacks, they won't invest in the right areas. A party chairman needs to not just lead the way on that, but release the funds for certain things that they think are important, and slightly older party chairmen sometimes don't think that kind of stuff's worth investing in. So you do need a mix of the both.
Danny, whenever you speak to whips or former whips, they always say the same thing, that reshuffles are an effing nightmare.
Yeah, so when you said, is this going to be a typical Theresa May operation, if you mean by that, you know, a sort of conscientious and sane appreciation of our own position, the answer to that is yes. Right. So,
there were some people urging,
I understand. So, one of the things that's very important is that we use the phrase a weak prime minister interchangeably between saying she is a weak person and she is in a weak position, but those are in fact different things, right? And the thing that affects the reshuffle is primarily the question of whether she is in a strong or weak position. I think were she in a strong position, she probably would want to reshuffle the Chancellor and the Foreign Secretary to get a Chancellor that was more amenable to a bold political strategy, because probably she wants one that's less fiscally conservative and works with her more closely. And Boris, we've discussed the reasons why a Prime Minister might be frustrated with him. But on the up, those people, for good or ill, represent strands of opinion in the Conservative Party, and she's in a position where she doesn't have a majority and she can't afford to make changes. In addition to which, I am really sceptical about the political value of these things. Most people, you know, when Philip Hammond made his budget mistake, I phoned up a pollster friend of mine and asked, you know, will this damage him and make him look gaffe prone? And he said, no, because no one knows he's Chancellor of the Exchequer. So we massively overestimate the extent to which anyone will notice. Now, then there's Katie's correctly phrased question about the chairmanship. So which you can take on any number of things, which is, by replacing them, will you get somebody who will be much more effective in that position? Well, clearly, if you had somebody who was a much more effective party chairman, it might affect your electoral prospects to some degree. Again, let's not overestimate. One of the reasons the Conservative Party got tanked on social media is because is because social media is a peer-to-peer communications product, and the Conservative Party is 40% behind among the people who use it. So therefore, almost all, and it was, so it was at least as much effect as it was caused. So I think she is correct to have a cold, sober appreciation of her position and to make the limited changes that that allows, not expecting some... Now, the most difficult one of those is the Chancellor, right? Because clearly it does actually make a difference if you have a Chancellor who can develop an election-winning strategy. Nothing is more important in terms of winning the next election than somebody who is going to end up landing on the nose in the next general election with personal incomes growing, right? And you have to be sure you've got a Chancellor of the Exchequer with a sufficiently political appreciation of that. But at the moment, as well as potentially holding that back, Philip Hammond is also the voice of sanity for people like me on issues which we're not allowed to mention without
So all right then, if not Boris and Hammond, who else would you sack to free up some space to promote some people? Let's start with you, Katie, as you started it.
I would probably move Liz Truss from the Cabinet. I think that the 2015-2010 intake feel that they could give it a go themselves.
This is Chief Secretary of the Treasury.
Absolutely. I'm not necessarily saying that someone outside the Cabinet should take that role. Someone should probably move aside. And there's a couple of others possibly that could move. But I don't think it's going to be a big Cabinet reshuffle. It's going to be a ministerial reshuffle.
Lucy?
I'm not going to get into kind of advocating anyone to be sacked. I'm a reporter and need to keep my cards rather dry. But I do think that there is a sense that... People with ideas and with character. I slightly disagree that the role of chairman shouldn't be overestimated, because I think the party just completely lacks any mojo at the moment. So I'd just like to see some people, even new roles created, sort of ambassadorial roles for the party, people with ideology or with ideas and with kind of character to try and rejuvenate. It just feels so down in the dumps. It's sort of depressing.
What we're saying here, I guess, today is that actually this is about party management.
Rather than
the public ever noticing any change or indeed calling for any change.
Yeah, not many people might notice it, but they are in all SW1.
Look, it will, of course, if you have a chairman organising, you know, Andrew Folmer made a big difference, right? The way he raised money, the way he organised things, it did make a big difference. So, of course, it makes a big difference if you in organisational terms, but it is not the thing that will alter the election. The key thing about it is your economic and fundamental political strategy that will make the difference. And I don't think that the reshuffle is going to determine that.
It won't stop us speculating about it, though. Let's move on now, and we'll, if and when there is a reshuffle, we'll cast a critical eye over it when it happens. But let's move on now, and this is Daniel Finkelstein.
The Tory ascendancy wasn't just built on support for capitalism, it was also built on Atlanticism. And it's this second pillar that's in even more trouble than the first. Jeremy Corbyn will mount a full-scale assault on the traditional foreign policy of the country, and at the moment, there's almost no public argument about it.
So I thought this is a really interesting topic, and because it's not one that comes up one week and down the next, it sort of doesn't really get talked about. It's sort of just bubbling away in the background. Our relationship, our position on the world stage, and we might end up using the B word in that a bit, but also our relationship with America and America's current relationship with the entire world, is all being sort of undermined and shifting all the time. And nobody's really making the case for it.
Well, it was interesting. So there's been lots of debate at the moment in the Conservative Party about, you know, saving capitalism. How do we make sure capitalism works for everybody? And it just occurred to me that the Conservative ascendancy, and if you look at the 1983 election, which everyone always talks about in relation to Corbyn, it was won on three things. One was, you know, we can't go on as we are with this interventionist economic policy. It's been a disaster, so we're going to have tough economic medicine, right? And that was a winning message. The second was actually, ironically enough, we need to stay in the European Union, not leave it. And the third one was, we are not going to have unilateral nuclear disarmament, which will undermine NATO and destroy our relationships with the United States of America. And those things were all powerful messages, and people accepted them. And the Conservative Party went back always to the Munich analogy, you know, we don't want to be surrendering like we did before Munich and appeasing, although forgetting that, of course, it was the party that had negotiated Munich. In other words, that the position that we've grown up and become used to, which is Britain is an interventionist international political power, which has been part of our history, a lot of our history, is not always the attitude of governments, and not inevitably the attitude of the American government either, which has gone through long periods of isolationism. So Theodore Roosevelt, for example, was in the early 1900s the first president to visit another country. The United States went in and out of isolationism, and Franklin Roosevelt found it very difficult to pull the United States back, even when the Second World War started. So we are in a fundamentally new international position, and Jeremy Corbyn in particular wants to change our position to a neutralist position. And if you ask, you know, his view on almost all of these conflicts, they are, you know, neutralist peacemaker positions. I think they will not create peace, but that is what he wants to do. That is a big challenge to traditional foreign policy of the country, which has been the foreign, when I say traditional, certainly been the position throughout the entire post-war era. And there's been almost no discussion. It was not an issue, for example, the Prime Minister felt called upon to speak about in her address to the party conference. That has almost never been the case in the past. But I think it was probably a sensible editing decision on her behalf. But that's pretty interesting.
And it's interesting that what we've seen is people ascribing the rise of Corbyn's popularity to austerity fatigue. And he sort of chimed with this shift in the public mood. But actually this sort of interventionist conflict fatigue of Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. And he's sort of chiming with that even though at the time those interventions were supported by the public, just the sort of cumulative effect and having seen them play out in not quite the way that everyone hoped they would, that actually just not doing something seems like a better way of...
I mean, the Syria vote was a major moment in post-war political history. Alongside...
Do you mean the first one when Ned Miliband was leader?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the decision not to do anything, really, when Syria crossed the red line. It was also actually pretty important in America's post-war political history, in fact, too. And I just feel that we've concentrated on this question, how do we restore the Conservative Party's, or how does the Conservative Party restore its, depending which way you sit, its position on the economy and capitalism, or do we replace it, without actually reflecting on the fact that probably the things that Corbyn cares about most are not those things, but foreign policy, but non-aligned foreign policy. And, you know, we're about to go into an election in the next few years in which the Labour Party will be led by somebody who wants a non-aligned foreign policy. A very important moment in the history of the whole of the West that Britain would take that position, which we've never taken. I think we have almost had no debate about this particular issue, and the Conservative Party hasn't attempted to shore up its position or debate that, and I just thought I'd raise it.
Lucy, it was interesting at the weekend we saw Young Labour passing a motion saying that Britain should leave NATO. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's a part of the Labour organisation, but...
Yeah, it was rather a confused motion that sort of regretted sort of the UK's part in the Vietnam War, which might surprise any scholars of history. I think Danny's points are really interesting, but to my mind, it's Donald Trump who's done more to undermine Atlanticism and not just the sort of weakening the special relationship because on the grounds of taste, I think, to many Britons, you know, his sexism, his chauvinism, his anti-migrant, immigrant sentiment is very distasteful. But because he was the original person flip-flopping on NATO. Jeremy Corbyn's, been making this argument for a long time, against American imperialism. But Donald Trump, when he was a candidate for the president and then when president, seemed to be so weak on it that I think that has done enormous amount of damage to the future of the alliance. But I do think that the government in Britain should be talking more about foreign policy. It was very interesting to me that in the general election campaign, how much Labour's focus on Saudi Arabia, Britain selling arms to Saudi then being involved in the war in Yemen, how much play that seemed to get to me on social media as I saw it. And I think the government could be doing much more to make the argument about why we have these alliances. So I was with the Prime Minister in April this year when she went to Saudi. I was very surprised and interested to see Saudi later this year announce that they're going to allow women to drive. That was exactly something that Theresa May was talking about in Saudi earlier this year. And yet, you know, the government's not making the argument, you know, we're going over there. We have soft power influence that's, you know, some of the criticisms people make of the regimes we deal with on grounds of human rights or oppression. You know, we are helping by maintaining alliances rather than shutting ourselves off from the rest of the world.
We had a fascinating debate on the issue of Saudi Arabia in an episode that Melanie Phillips was on earlier this year, which foreign policy is complicated. Mm. And sometimes my enemy's enemy is my friend, mm-hmm. and my enemy's enemy, enemy. And it's complicated. And where you can't just say good guys, bad guys, which is sometimes the tendency of possibly students and the leader of the Labour Party. Katie, what's your perception of the sort of limited amount of time and limited number of messages a Prime Minister can be communicating? Is foreign policy a harder sell? Is it sort of judged as voters aren't interested in it, so we don't talk about it?
It's an easier sell when you're 24 points ahead in the polls, that's for sure. And so when your bandwidth is taken up by lots of other things and your civil service is, you know, quite busy dealing with those other things we're not allowed to talk about, I feel that maybe it does go on the back burner somewhat. But it doesn't mean to say that Theresa May doesn't think that she doesn't feel that, you know, that responsibility, and that's exactly why those relationships are still open in the way that Lucy describes, and that's what some of the things that they want to do behind closed doors. It's much easier to explain to someone who's kind of 40 or 50 years old that has understands that things in life are not clear cut than a 20-year-old who thinks it's all kind of, you know, these people are evil and therefore we should never deal with them ever again. I also think that it was quite a proud moment, actually, when I went with the Prime Minister to the US, because we didn't go straight to see Trump. We went to Philadelphia first for kind of a pit stop where the Prime Minister spoke to the Republicans at their convention about what it was really the only time I've properly seen her stand up and give a foreign policy speech. And it was exactly why I think people think that, you know, the Conservatives have a home for them. It's exactly why we have a purpose in the world. And it showed that these things are important to her and important to a Conservative government. It's just that there's no kind of appetite or space to keep on banging on about it. But I think Danny's got a point. I worry that in 10, 20 years' time, we will think we missed the opportunity to stand up for some of these things that are important. I wrote down Syria in my notes as you were speaking before you mentioned it, saying that this was a moment I think we shied away from the world and we will, you know, live to see the consequences.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's very important. Lucy, you're completely correct, of course, and you know, I wouldn't want for a second to be not to say that clearly the biggest crisis in the Atlantic relationship is the president, his insularity, his bigotry, and his unreliability, frankly, and unfitness to hold that kind of office or be the leader. But it's more, I use the phrase Atlanticism less about our relationship with the current American regime than to mean our view of Britain as a global voice for liberal democracy and values, and you put it very well. Clearly one of the problems with asserting an international role as Atlanticists is the current very miserable state of our partnership, and the fact that it's also happening at a time when we're, you know, when our relationships with other European powers is more fragile than it was, is obviously very concerning. It's just worthwhile noting we spent a lot of time considering the weakness of that of the first big pillar of the Conservative ascendancy, which is capitalism, and not enough thinking, well, there are all these things that are assailing that second pillar. And in particular, and it's going to face a proper intellectual challenge, which maybe can be ignored because it's not that electorally potent, you know, foreign policy and our policy towards, you know, non-aligned states and things like that are not important. But the idea that we're about to embark on what might be either neutralist or what's might be called, using a sort of slightly odd phrase, anti-imperialist foreign policy, that will become a very significant part of world affairs. And Jeremy Corbyn is proposing a very big change in the way that we approach world politics. And there's not much discussion of that.
Okay, so just before we wrap up, just describe briefly the calculation that was made about going to Washington when you did with Theresa May, and obviously taking the decision that trying to sort of bind Trump in at the beginning was a good idea, and, you know, whether the hand-holding photo and all of that ends up becoming a problem for Theresa May rather than, you know, it was a gamble, but it might be one that, that doesn't pay off.
Well, some things are out of your control, and certainly that picture wasn't something that I planned to be the splash the next day. I'd spent a lot of time and effort making sure that it was a press conference with, you know, the vision of both of them standing in front of the flags and saying very nice things towards each other was going to be the thing that we went from not holding hands, going down a step. But they, as I say, they're out of your control. The decision to actually was to hold off until inauguration because there were calls very early on to go much earlier, and indeed the president kept on, the would-be president kept on inviting us, saying do come. And so we waited to be the first to go after inauguration, but we were quick to move out there because it was very important for us to be seen that we do value the US. We are leaving the European Union, and then we're looking further afield for stronger relationships. The quick move to do that, and actually it was Theresa May's brilliance, actually, when she rolled him into a commitment on NATO in that press conference that even I didn't expect. I knew that we were going to try and get some kind of commitment, not live in front of millions of people watching.
Because she basically said, and you're totally committed to NATO as
well,
aren't you?
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. And he said, yes. And don't forget, this was his first proper press conference with a foreign leader. He didn't know what he was doing. She knew exactly what she was doing. And I thought she did a brilliant, brilliant job at that event. And but, you know, offering a state visit probably wasn't a very good idea. It was probably jumping the gun a bit too much, and it's not something I thought was necessary at the time. But it was a trip that went really well because also we had great time with the Republicans, so we got to spend some time with various other people, John McCain, others. So we got to spend some quality time with people to show the commitment that we have to this relationship. And then of course it all went wrong because we went to Turkey afterwards, and that was a bit of a rubbish trip. So you live and learn.
Well, it's fascinating. And what happens with his scaled down or otherwise state visit, working visit at some point next year will be fascinating, not least to see quite how many people turn out to give him a warm welcome. That's all we've got time for this week, unfortunately. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and if you could leave a review there, that would be even better, as long as they're nice ones. You can sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, from Daniel Finkelstein, Katie Perrier, Lucy Fisher, and me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.